The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether we all live inside a wormhole. Some new physics theory here, Dave?
Well, Rob, I wouldn't go as far as a theory, but at least it's a hypothesis. And this is how the hypothesis goes. A long time ago, in a universe much larger than our own, a giant star collapsed. And when this star collapsed, the implosion crammed so much mass and energy together that it created a wormhole that opened up a porthole to another universe. And between these two universes, our own universe came to be.
So an alternative for the Big Bang.
Well, exactly. That's actually one of the reasons the researcher in question proposed this pretty fantastic hypothesis. Because as much as we all love the Big Bang theory, it has some problems. One of the problems is the theory of gravity. It turns out there are some problems with gravity. What researchers ultimately would like to do is unify all of the fundamental forces in the universe, and that includes gravity and what's called the nuclear forces and electromagnetism, into one grand unified theory. And they can do that with the other forces, but they can't for some reason do it with gravity. And one of the ways they try to unify all these forces is trace them all back to the very origins of our universe. This event, sometimes called the singularity, that happened 13.7 billion years ago, where there was nothing, and then all of a sudden there was a rapid expansion of our universe. And no matter how far they go back, they can't unify gravity with these other forces. The other problem with our universe, if you will, is the problem of dark energy. And dark energy is this mysterious force that's been hypothesized to explain why our universe keeps on expanding at an accelerating rate when gravity should actually slow this expansion or reverse it. As much as we like the Big Bang and as much as we like our universe, there are some things that we just can't quite square away yet.
So how does this wormhole hypothesis account for these things?
Well, the wormhole hypothesis actually solves both of those problems. First, it solves the problem of gravity by saying, hey, there was an event that happened even before the Big Bang, which was there was already another universe in existence. And this universe, for all intents and purposes, spawned our own universe. And when this researcher did his calculations, he found that now he was able to theoretically trace all these forces. When you trace all these forces to an event even before the Big Bang, theoretically, they may come to a point where they can all be unified in some sort of grand theory. And the wormhole hypothesis also solves this problem of the universe's expansion. Because if you can imagine, and you actually can see a picture of this on the site, if our universe is actually trapped between two other universes and it's in the middle of a wormhole, it's actually being stretched by these universes at both ends. And this stretching could account for the expansion that we see in our universe without having to resort to something mysterious called dark energy.
How is this being received by the greater physics community?
Well, people are pretty skeptical, as you can imagine. I mean, this is all really more of a thought experiment than anything else. Even though the researcher has some calculations, he says his calculations are fairly preliminary. This is published research, so it has, you know, been accepted into a scientific journal. But some researchers say, you know, this is complete baloney. You know, we shouldn't even be thinking about stuff like this. It's completely ridiculous. But other researchers say, even if it is ridiculous, A, that doesn't mean it's not true. And B, it helps us think about, it's always useful to, you know, sort of propose these hypotheses because they sort of allow cosmologists and physicists to do some out-of-the-box thinking, because clearly we haven't been able to solve all the questions that we have right now with the theories we have in front of us.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from trying to figure out the mysteries of the universe to trying to figure out the mystery of racism, this next study is all about why people stereotype based on race.
Something about how we perceive people who look different than us?
Exactly. I mean, the question is, why do we, even if it's on an unconscious level, tend to stereotype people? Is it because we fear people who don't look like us or belong to social groups that are different from our social groups? Is it something that's just learned? Is it something that's innate? A lot of questions revolving around why racism persists in society.
So what did these researchers do?
These researchers attacked the question from a really interesting angle. They said, you know, if racism actually stems from our fear of other social groups, can we design an experiment that shows that that's actually the case? And what they did was they actually turned to children who have a very interesting genetic condition known as Williams syndrome. And this condition leads to mental retardation, but children who have it are also intensely social. In fact, one of the researchers talks about walking to a room with 50 kids with Williams syndrome, and they just run up to her and start hugging her and being very affectionate, even though they don't know her.
So no fear of strangers.
No fear of strangers. And the researchers said in this study, if we have these kids that don't have a fear of strangers, meaning they don't have this fear of other groups, might they also not have racial prejudice? And what they did was they gave these kids and a bunch of control kids a standard test that tests things like racial prejudice and even gender prejudice. There would be examples where they would show the children, say, a drawing of two boys, and one would have dark skin and one would have light skin. And the researchers say, now, one of these boys did something naughty. Which one do you think it was? Or they would show the children a picture of a boy and a girl, and they would say, which one of these do you think works at a gas station after school?
For a gender stereotype.
Exactly. And what the researchers found is that the control group tended to have a pretty strong racial bias. And in about 83% of their responses, and these were all white children that were taking this test, they tended to say that the darker-skinned individual was the one who had done something naughty. But with the kids with the Williams syndrome, they only had that response about 64% of the time. So they were much closer to almost an even split between not making a distinction between a light-skinned individual and a dark-skinned individual. But the researchers didn't see that same difference when they looked at gender. Both of the groups scored about more than 90% in saying that the boy was more likely to work at a gas station, which, you know, fulfills our sort of gender stereotypes about what kind of jobs boys would have versus what kind of jobs girls would have, or what type of jobs men would have and what type of jobs women would have. And what the researchers conclude from this is they're saying, you know, because of the difference that was shown with the racial stereotyping, that it does appear that it's this fear of strangers that really feeds into our attitudes about race. But this same process doesn't seem to work for our attitudes about gender. And that may mean that the stereotypes we form based on gender may actually have more to do with other cognitive processes, such as social learning.
But is it really fear that led to these stereotypes? Do you automatically assume that someone that you're afraid of is the person who's acting badly?
Well, one of the critiques an expert makes of this study is she says that it's not clear whether the kids with Williams syndrome actually are not afraid of these other races because they have so many other disabilities. They may actually have a disability in learning. So if racial prejudice is something we learn from our parents, and the kids with Williams syndrome aren't able to, say, learn this from their parents, then they would also be expected to have a very similar response on the test. And in that case, racial prejudice would be chalked up to social learning rather than a fear of outsiders. So the study isn't totally conclusive on that point.
Okay. So, Dave, for this last one, I see that you've brought a sound file with you. What is that sound?
Well, Rob, listen to this.
What is that?
That, I'm afraid to tell you, is a caterpillar scraping its butt on a leaf.
Is it that loud? I've never heard a caterpillar make a sound that loud before.
Well, Rob, in this case, the microphone is actually pretty close to the caterpillar's behind. But this is actually a very audible sound. In fact, the researcher that first picked up on the sound was rearing caterpillars in her dining room and walked into her room one day and actually heard this noise. She said, "What is this about?" So she starts studying these caterpillars. And the caterpillar you're actually hearing belongs to a group of caterpillars from the hook-tipped moth family of caterpillars. And these caterpillars have what's called, and I'm sorry to gross you out again, an anal oar. And this is sort of a hair-like structure on the rear end that allows them to scrape leaves and make this noise.
Why are they making this noise? Have researchers figured out the reason for this behavior?
They think that the caterpillars are making this noise to scare off intruders. Caterpillars have a pretty soft body and they don't like to get into fights because even the slightest nip can cause them to literally bleed to death. And so caterpillars have evolved the strategy of trying to warn off. So if another caterpillar gets on its leaf and this caterpillar wants to defend its territory, a lot safer to warn this caterpillar off by scraping your butt and making these loud sounds than engaging in an actual fight.
Here it is again.
And you can actually see a really cool video of this on the site. One of the things that's really interesting here, actually, is how the researchers think this butt scraping behavior evolved. This anal oar actually almost looks a little bit like a proto leg. So the researchers think, based on studies of some of the ancestors of this caterpillar and other caterpillars that are related to it, that this anal oar may have actually been, at first, may have been an appendage that evolved to help the caterpillar maybe walk, but over time it developed into this appendage that just helped it make noise. So it's a weird case, the researchers say, of where talking may have evolved from walking.
But this isn't talking.
Well,
it's communication.
It's communication. It's a way of saying, back off my leaf.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about a new mechanism for how cancer cells may metastasize and how that may lead to treatments to block tumor progression, and also a story about how water formed in our early solar system. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a very controversial story about how a federal advisory committee omitted two surveys that were supposed to gauge Americans' knowledge on evolution and astronomy, specifically the Big Bang, which we were talking about earlier, and why these particular questions were omitted from a National Science Foundation report. Also a story about the benefits of biotech crops for farmers. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.